Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Luke's English Podcast. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Barbara Serra, the Italian journalist who reads the news on television in the UK. She's a very interesting guest and has lots of interesting things to say about the way her identity and career have been shaped by her relationship to the English language. We're going to talk about reading the news in the UK when you sound like a foreigner, lots of questions around identity and accent, and all sorts of other things that Barbara has experienced in her time as a broadcast journalist. I think you'll find it very interesting as a learner of English, looking to improve your English as much as possible in different contexts, both personal and professional. Now, before we go on, I just want to give a little announcement about a Lepster meetup, which is happening in Vietnam later this month. Do you remember Lepster meetups? They used to happen quite a lot. I think COVID-19 pretty much put a stop to them, but there used to be Lepster meetups happening in various places. Well, there's going to be another one, and a Lepster meetup, a Lepster, just in case you don't know, this is a listener to Luke's English Podcast, LEP. That's Luke's English Podcast. A Lepster is someone who listens to the podcast. So if you're a regular listener to this show, then you're a Lepster. Congratulations. And a Lepster meetup is really a chance for listeners to this show to get together in some location, normally a bar or cafe or something, and just chat in English, talk about this and that, meet like-minded people and socialise in English. It can be a really good little way to build a community, find friends with whom you can practice speaking English. You might find people from different places who have a different first language, so you'll be forced to speak in English. It's basically a really good idea to socialise in English. And this one is being organised by Zdenek Lukas, who you might know from Zdenek's English Podcast. He's also organised lots of meetups in the past, and Zdenek likes to do things like different board games and other fun things to practice English. So Zdenek is organising a Lepster meetup in Da Nang in Vietnam on Friday the 17th of May. Okay, it's going to take place at Gordon's Pizza, which is in the An Thuong area of Da Nang, Vietnam. Right, Friday the 17th of May from 9 p.m. If you're interested in attending the meetup, just let Zdenek know. Send him an email just to say, "Hi, Zdenek, I'd like to take part in the meetup in Da Nang." Just something like that. Just let him know. Send him an email. His address is teacherzdenek@gmail.com. Teacher, I think you know how to spell that. Zdenek is spelled Z-D-E-N-E-K. Okay, teacherzdenek@gmail.com. Just let him know if you'd like to take part in that meetup happening in Da Nang, in Gordon's Pizza, Friday the 17th of May from 9 p.m. Right, so back to this episode and back to my guest today, Barbara Serra. Barbara Serra is an award-winning Italian journalist who spent much of her career reading the news in the UK on various high-profile, well-established English language news networks, including the BBC, Channel 5, Al Jazeera English, and Sky News. So she's a newsreader, you know, when it's like 6 o'clock or 10 o'clock or something, it's the news, and you have a person sitting behind a desk reading the news in various different sort of ways. There's also reporters, people who are out on location reporting the news as well. So this is what Barbara does, and she's done it in English, in the UK, on various news networks. Now, Barbara has quite a specific relationship with English. It's her dominant language, but not her native language. And she's going to explain what that means in this conversation. She has a certain accent in English, which does place her outside the UK somehow. So how has this affected her career as a newsreader and reporter? Broadcast journalism is associated with a certain kind of model of spoken English. In the UK, that will be what is often called BBC English. And traditionally, the role of newsreaders, this role has been synonymous with that kind of high-level, high-status form of English. So what has Barbara's experience been? What is the story of her English? How did she get to the point where she was ready to actually do this job? What kind of challenges has she faced while reading the news in the UK with a certain accent? And what does this tell us about learning English, what it means to improve your accent, the relationship between accent and identity, the definition of native and non-native speaker, the status of different English accents in the English-speaking world, and more? So that's what we're going to be talking about. So I think it's time to get started. So here we go. So maybe the good place to begin would be to ask about your background and your linguistic background. Where are you from, and how does English come into your upbringing?
Thank you for starting with that, because that's sort of what gave me the idea to start working on language as well. So I'll tell you about the linguistic background, but basically I'm a broadcast journalist, and I have worked over the past 20, 25 years for the major broadcasters. I was an intern at CNN, and then BBC, Sky News, Al Jazeera, English, and now I'm back at Sky News. And because I inhabit this weird world where native speakers can tell I'm second language, and second language English speakers sometimes think I'm native, but actually they don't really, and often I slip, you know, I have my moments. Mm-hmm. And so I would often get these emails from fellow, you know, second language English speakers, younger journalists who wanted to get on air, and they'd ask for advice. And I realized after a while that I was lying to them, because I would get into the phase of saying, oh, you know, you've got to think laterally, outside the box, be ambitious, be creative, be curious. And then actually I realized that the real question I had to ask any of them before, you know, in the first 20 seconds of the conversation was, how good is your English, first of all? And second question, can you kind of pass as a native speaker? And I realized actually that to all these young journalists that were getting in touch, unless I asked those two questions and unless I was brutally honest about the reality of that, I was effectively, you know, leading them down the garden path, which is exactly the kind of expression that I try not to use when I'm speaking to second language English speakers. But, you know, I was giving them false illusions, or at least not being honest about the difficulties. So I am a native Italian speaker. My parents are both Italian. I was born there. I lived there till I was about 9 years old. And then my family moved to Denmark, and I went to an international school. And, you know, anyone who's been to international schools knows it's a bit of a mix. And so that kind of set the imprint to how I sound. First of all, I learned English as a child, not a young child. I have very, very clear memories of not speaking English, actually. And I remember walking into that class, you know, when you're nine, you're not that young. And I remember walking in that class and feeling that strange sense of alienation where you literally can't understand a word that's being said. And I have to say, without trying to make everything fit neatly, I do think that sense of alienation always gave me an empathy with being othered, you know, with being different, and with there being genuine barriers to feeling part of something. So I think that shaped my career in many ways. Apart from the linguistic, I think it shaped the sense behind it. Mm. And then linguistically, I mean, I'll give you all the missing bits to the, because you'll get it and the audience will get it when people ask me, where's your accent from? So native Italian, but I learn it in Denmark. So actually I learn it surrounded by people, mainly Danes, who speak it as a second language. But the woman who taught me, because often in international schools, you have someone who follows you for the first few months to help you with the English specifically, was American or Canadian. And I think you can hear that. And I think that is still there. And then it's the retroflexive R, which I can bore you about at length and often do.
Yeah, we like that kind of stuff. Here. Look,
exactly. I that's why I'm here. I'm so excited about having that conversation. And so I think it's a mix. I think it's international English. And I think a lot of people who are second language English speakers actually learn it in an environment that's not an English speaking country. And it's completely different. If I had come to the UK age 9, I'm pretty confident I would sound almost, you know, completely British. There might be something slightly perceptible of the Italian, but actually I think if I'd come to the UK age 9, then I would probably sound British now. But I didn't. That wasn't what happened in my formative years and the years where I learned English. So I was in this international school from the ages of 9 till 19, you know, and linguistically, that's by 19, let's face it, it's set, you know, what I call the sort of, I don't know, mouth settings are fixed. And so I learned it in this weird way where, you know, the kind of, I had this American or Canadian teacher that I think probably, you know, put that little imprint. But then in truth, I also learned English surrounded by people that spoke it in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways.
Sorry, where were they from? These are your friends or classmates?
I mean, you know, so there were quite a lot of Brits. They tended to leave when you got to secondary school because quite a lot of them would come back to the UK for boarding school. But in the early years, quite a lot of Brits, some Americans, but then a lot of people that didn't have it as their first language. You know, Israelis, Germans, Spaniards, Portuguese, other Italians, although we would all speak English together. Obviously, lots of Scandinavians, but, you know, Chinese, Indian, Pakistani, you know, it was an international school. I mean, Nigeria, you know, you name it. It was like that. And I think all of us, in a way, you do conform, don't you, to a kind of international English. This is the 80s and 90s where culturally, I would guess there was an American dominance. And so you ended up watching a lot of American stuff on TV. And it sounds simplistic, but it was cool to be American. So it was cool to try to sound American. And we're all listening to American bands. So that played a part. But really, it's a mix. And I think what is slightly odd in my voice is as Danish as it is Italian. I don't actually think I have an Italian imprint. I think what is odd in my, you know, that, you know what I mean by odd? That's like slightly weird thing that people go, where is she from?
Yeah.
I think that's Danish as much as anything because I never spoke English with Italians.
When you are in you live in the UK, right?
I've been here for 30 years, yeah.
Right.
Not that you'd know, but yes, from the way I sound, it hasn't rubbed off.
Well, when you meet British people, for example, in some situation, you know, you're just at a dinner party or something, or, you know, meeting new people, and they first start talking to you, and there's that moment where they kind of think to themselves, well, what's the reaction that they have? What are the things they say to you about? They, you know, they say, where are you from, actually? And they ask you that question. Where do people think you're from? How do people react to your English?
It's interesting. More than where are you from, which I also think has become a little bit of a toxic question. And interestingly, I think the whole issue of accent and language and nationality and, you know, the sort of toxic, but asking where are you from, it depends how you ask and why, right?
Yeah.
So interestingly, people will say, where is your accent from, right? So I can mock it up if I have to, and I used to have to. So I can say I'm driving my car instead of driving my car, right? Mm-hmm. And for a while I was forced to when I worked in British broadcasting, to be honest. I've stopped doing it because actually I like to signal to people that I am slightly different, that there is something, you know, that I am what I am, that I'm someone of a different heritage. So they will ask, you know, where's your accent from? And then I launch into the slightly boring and lengthy, making them wish they'd never asked, you know, about Denmark, and, you know, and the Canadian teacher and all of that. But then when I say, oh, well, I'm from Italy, they go, oh, but I know that in a way they're lying because it's not a, oh, but, you know, no one has ever guessed Italian without knowing that I am Italian, which I think is interesting.
What do they normally guess, can I ask?
If they can see me, I will get a lot of like Brazilian, Argentinian, or Canadian, sometimes American, but Americans know I'm not American, right? Mm-hmm. So if they can see me, and I know this is a podcast, so let me give like the audio description. I have a Mediterranean coloring, right? You know, olive skin, dark hair, dark eyes, and a mannerism, which I think you could call, I don't know, Latin, you know? So then they would say that, but I think people are just genuinely confused. But anyone who has an international background will know, you know, we don't sound, all of us who have learned it in different places that will have different influences, and you can't just put us in a box. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. So you developed this kind of international English with these sort of imprints of the different influences that you had in those formative years, 9 to 19, that you talked about. And so there you are. You're fluent at that point, right? When you get to about the age of 20 and you're looking at what to do next. You went to the UK and studied there. Was that the next step?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, all my studies were in English. And I mean, this is going to annoy all the younger listeners, but back in the day, UK universities were free. And also London was a very, I mean, still is, an incredibly appealing destination. And, you know, I'd left Italy when I was very young. I love Italy. I always try to go back, but I'm not going to pretend that when I go to Italy, I fit in. I mean, I have an accent in Italian as well. So,
do you really?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
A regional Italian accent or a sort of a foreign Italian accent?
A sort of foreign. Well, first of all, I have linguistic issues with Italian in the sense that I have much more linguistic dexterity in English because I've always used it for work. So from the age of 9, all my academic studies were in English. But also, you know, the books I read, the friends I had. Then obviously I did uni in English. Then I started working as a journalist. I also work in Italian as a journalist. I actually write books and articles in Italian as well as English. But I could put it this way. I could never write in Italian without having an online Italian-English dictionary open in front of me. But I can write in English without having the Italian-English dictionary just because I'm fixed.
So... What's your first language, and are you a native English speaker or a non-native English speaker? And what does that term even mean, native English speaker?
So I think second language English speaker and native English speakers are almost, there's almost a difference there as well. To me, native English speaker was it either your mother tongue or did you learn it as a child? So, and to me really is, do you remember a time when you didn't speak English? And to me, if you can't remember a time when you couldn't speak English, as far as I'm concerned, you're a native speaker. Because like my son, for example, I'm raising him in two languages, right? So you could argue first 6 months of his life, I tried to only speak to him in Italian. Does that make him a native Italian speaker? Of course not, because he was growing up in the UK and it's his language. But he will be truly native in two languages in a way that I wasn't, because he will never remember not speaking Italian and he will never remember not speaking English. You know, he will never remember having to learn how to pronounce the TH sound. Like, I am very proud of my Vs. Thank you. I'm glad you're not doing that.
You know, well done.
Thank you. I feel the ovation. And so to me, it's native. But second language is trickier because, I mean, certainly English is my dominant language, you know, and has been for decades. And it would be unfair of me to pretend otherwise, also because, and forgive the arrogance, but I do get a lot of messages of people saying, you know, their ambition is to have an English like mine because they see me reading the news. And I have to be honest, you know, it's been my dominant language since age 9.
Yeah.
And so it's my second language. I'm not a native speaker, but it is my dominant language. And I use it for work in a job where language is everything. So, you know.
You're sort of in between the kind of the broad definitions of the two things, native speaker and non-native speaker. You sort of don't quite fit into those basic broad definitions. You're kind of somewhere in between almost, although you have said that you don't consider yourself to be a native speaker. But yeah, it is your dominant language. You've worked on your English, though, as well as just sort of learning it as part of your upbringing. You have since actually had to work on it in a focused and considered way, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I've just remembered I should bring my bone prop to show you. Do you know what a bone prop is?
A bone prop?
Have you
prop?
Ever heard of it? A bone prop is something that you put between its mouth exercises to sharpen your diction.
Right. And well, I've never heard of it called a bone prop before. For me, it was always just called a pen. Because yes, every now and then I do get my learners of English to put a pen between their teeth or in their mouth or something like that to help them practice their pronunciation. So yeah, tell us about it's called a bone prop.
It's a bone prop, and it can be a pen, it can be anything that's roughly, I don't know, an inch long that you put between your teeth, put it here, and then you speak. And because it makes it harder to speak, because obviously your mouth is in a natural position, it works out your tongue and it's meant to help with your diction. I hope it does, because I've been doing it for years and I'll always try to do it. You know, if I have time, I'll do, when I read my scripts before going on air, I will read my scripts with a bone prop in. I'm sure a lot of it is psychological at this point, but I'll do that. So let me just go back to how that came about. So look, I started working. I came to the UK, did uni. Then I did a postgrad in journalism. And then I tried to get jobs. And actually, it went okay. So whenever I talk about language and some of the difficulties, I just want to make it very clear that I don't put this in the discrimination box. I don't think that I was treated badly. I don't think it was because I'm foreign. It was because I'm foreign, but not because, like, ooh, we don't want foreigners on air. I think language, if you are a broadcast journalist, I mean, it's your everything. And you cannot compromise on the clarity and the message. And then if you become a TV presenter, because I never had issues when I was a reporter, but when you become a TV presenter, there's so many different things that make audiences relate to you, you know? Language is one of them, accent. You know, it's elements of trust. It's elements of feeling that you're one of them, that you're their voice, that you understand their problems. So I just want to make it very clear that this isn't some woe is me, I was treated so badly story. It's just the reality, I think, of when you use language. So anyway, so I was lucky. I started getting jobs at the BBC and obviously before off air, but then, you know, I really wanted to be on air. So I started doing, you know, can I do the weekend reporting shift and all of that? And then I started presenting. You know, one of the bosses said, look, it could work. And this was BBC London. So for people who don't know, BBC London is like, there's the main 6 o'clock news in the UK that the whole country tunes into, you know, back in the day when people would tune into a TV program at 6 p.m. So 6 to 6:30 was the national program. 6:30 to 7 was the regional program. So if you're in Yorkshire, it'd be BBC Yorkshire, you know, wherever you were. And in London, it's BBC London. And I started doing that. Not the main 6:30 program, but I would do the other injects, either during the day or actually the evening one after the 10 o'clock news, which bizarrely gets even more viewers. And I think that's where the problems started. Now, look, I obviously wasn't as, this is a long time ago. I wasn't as polished. I think I must have had that, you know, rabbit in the headlights kind of look, because, you know, you always do when you start. But looking back, you know, you could see, you know, so I don't think I was taken off air because they thought, oh, she's terrible. I was taken off air because viewers started complaining. And I remember this one email that came into the BBC newsroom, because remember, this is like 2003. This is before Facebook, right? So just bear that in mind. So people used to email in, and I'll never forget this email that came in, and it said, I don't pay my license fee to have the news read by a foreigner. And again, for those, oh, I know. Do you know, now I laugh at the time, it was a bit like, because it tied in a lot of insecurities. But, you know, I get what that person meant, and I don't think that person was wrong, right? I don't think that person was wrong.
Because?
Because news is about trust, and trust is tribal. And what my voice will tell you, specifically in the UK, right? That I am not of the tribe. My voice will tell you, I mean, the one thing my voice will tell you straight away, I was not born in the UK. You know that. That's the one thing that any Brit can deduce the second they hear me. And if you're doing something like a news program, if you're presenting the news and you're talking about, you know, like deprivation and poverty or, you know, A&E waiting times or not being able to get an appointment with your doctor, you know, these are all, you know, schools or old people's homes. These are all like really local issues, actually. And you need to feel, I think, when you're watching the news, that that person understands you. It may be a lie, because maybe the person reading the news, you know, it's quite cushy in their cushy, well-paid job and actually has no idea what it's like to be homeless. But there has to be a sort of idea that they can have the empathy with certain situations. And I think, you know, sounding foreign is a barrier and it's not anybody's fault. You know, I don't think, look, that comment really hurt. I'm not going to sit here and pretend it was like, you know, the best time of my life ever. But nor do I think, you know, I don't think that person was racist or anything like that. I think that person had a point, maybe put it in quite a brutal way, but had a point. So anyway, so the BBC take me off air quite unceremoniously. The one thing that annoys me is that it's London. I do think London has a different dynamic, but we're just going to gloss over that, you know?
Yeah, because you'd maybe hope that London was a bit more metropolitan and cosmopolitan, and that people wouldn't have that kind of view. But then London, it includes many other areas around London. It's not just sort of like central London, which is probably the really cosmopolitan place. It's also lots of other sort of more suburban areas too. Yeah.
And bear in mind, this is 2003, right? It's different. I think now the recent census has London at 40% foreign born, 40.
Wow.
And again, foreign born, not ethnic minorities, not minority religions. You know, we have to be careful. You know, we can't just mix everything in one. There's a lot of overlaps, but this is foreign born. Now, many of them will have come as children, so they will sound British, but you know, it's kind of. So anyway, so that happens. And I'm like, oh, boo. So I start looking for jobs elsewhere. And then actually bless them, Sky. Well, not bless them. I mean, thank you. But Sky hired me as a junior reporter. And they were very clear. They're like, look, we want to train you up, but you know, we see you in foreign positions, which is great. I mean, I did the death of Pope John Paul II. Then from that to the Michael Jackson trial, which was a very funny juxtaposition of stories from the Vatican to, you know, Hollywood. And then from there, I get spotted by the then head of Channel 5. And they were looking for a presenter. And he said, look, I've seen some of your stuff. I think you are a presenter. Why don't you come and present on Channel 5 News? So I'm like, amazing. And I do that. And then at that point, we're national, right? Channel 5 is national.
So listeners, at this point in the story, Channel 5, 2003, 2004, right?
No, this is by this point, because I've done a couple of years as a reporter at Sky. So this is 2005.
Okay, so we're in the region, in the period when there were quite a lot of channels. If you had a Freeview box, which was like a kind of a digital box, I think that you would connect to your TV, but still many homes around the country still basically had just five channels, five well-established TV channels, and a bunch of extras if you could sort of like connect a box to your TV, or if you had a fancy new TV that had it in built. So five channels. BBC One, BBC Two, then ITV and Channel 4. Those two were the commercial channels, but still sort of part of the sort of national broadcasting sort of network, still kind of...
public service.
Still part of the public service broadcasting system. And then a fifth channel, Channel 5, which at that time, when you were contacted by them, was still fairly new.
So it was about a year old.
Yeah.
Sorry, not a year, no, 10 years old nearly, because they launched in 97, you know, famously in front of the desk. You know,
yes.
We didn't sit down, we stood up.
Yeah, okay. Just that little bit more informal. But the point is, yeah, it was a national TV channel and their news was national news. So it was broadcast around the whole country.
Yeah. And at tea time, it was the 6 o'clock. Well, at Channel 5, it was 5. But so... the evening news, you know, the one that you'd watch when you came home from work, was BBC One at 6, ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5. So actually, there were four, you know, primetime news programs in the early evening, and I would present one of them. So actually, it was, you know, when I look back, it was quite a big deal. And it didn't work there either. So after about 3 months, I get called in by the boss. And again, I like it when people are honest. And he said, look, Barbara, you know, a third of the viewers don't really care about your accent. A third of the viewers think, you know, it's kind of like cool and different, or maybe, you know, cosmopolitan, whatever. And he said, but a third of viewers really object to it. And it's a barrier. And he was honest. And he said, I cannot have a primetime presenter that a third of the viewers feel alienated by. I mean, ultimately, that's what it is. He was kind enough not to use those words, for which I'm grateful, but that's what it was.
Yeah.
And so this is 2000. And at this point, I'm like, oh, okay, you know, I kind of like, I've seen the pattern. You can only bang your head against the wall so many times. And by the way, in the middle of all of this at Sky News, when I was reporting, that's when I started the voice training. Because even with reporting, in the first 3 months, at one point again, I was called into an office and said, look, I listen to you. I hear CNN. I don't hear Sky News. And that was the boss. And I said, well, no one ever said anything. And I can try and change it. And he said, I don't think people can change their accents. And I did the whole, like, let me try. And he did let me try. He gave me another, was very, a lot of drama in all of this. And he did let me try. And they sent me to a voice coach, a wonderful woman called Valerie Savage, who, you know, passed away a couple of years ago. But genuinely, when I say that woman changed my life and career, she did.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And so we did a lot of voice coaching, and she did two things. She made me sound clearer. She gave me, you know, better tempo, so better use of my diaphragm, so I don't run out of breath. Also knowing how to control, because, you know, when you're on air, you get a lot of adrenaline, which is the worst thing that should happen, when actually you just need to sit there and feel really, you know, relaxed and chilled and, oh, let me bring you the news. Yeah. But actually the adrenaline often, you know, makes your vocal cords shrink. It just all sorts of things. And so she taught me a lot of that, which is just basic broadcasting, basic speaking, actually. So she's the one that taught me how to use the bone prop. We did a lot of tongue twisters. I still do them now. I like Lily, little Lily Lee. I like Lily, Lily likes me. Lily likes lollipops, lemonade, and lime drops. Or what a to do to die today at a minute or two to two, a thing distinctly hard to say. I messed it up there. And harder still to do. So the L's, the T's, she really listened to what was, she used to call it flabby in my voice. And she sharpened all of that. And then she also tried to knock the dreaded retroflexive R.
What is that then?
So I'm driving my car. I'm driving my car. You know?
Yeah. Car.
Yeah, car. Yeah. It's that, and I mean, listen, I'm not, it's the bending of the R backwards. So my name is in Italian, Barbara Serra, or Barbara Serra, or Barbara Serra.
You know? So the Italian one first.
Well, the Italian is like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the American was like Barbara. Right.
But you see, you say American, but a lot of people think I'm Scottish, because the Scots have the R. The West of England has the R. I mean, crikey. Devon, Cornwall.
Right. You're down in Devon. Oh, Barbara. So I spoke to that Barbara Sarah again.
A little bit. The Irish.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Most people, to be honest, most people in the world, it's just, you know, it's just the English who are like, no, we will not pronounce our R's. I don't care how many other people are doing it.
Yeah. And, but it is actually the thing that because I think the rest of my speech pattern actually is quite British. I mean, I joke about the UK not having had any imprint on my voice, but that's not true. I think the speech patterns I use, the expressions I use, often it depends, but the vowels, the way that I use, I don't Americanize that much. But the R was so difficult for me. That's the one thing that just made me sound unnatural and unauthentic. And they sort of really wanted me to do that at, Sky, and again, this is Sky a long time ago. I'm back at Sky now. I mean, they seem happy. They're still, you know, so they seem happy with the way I sound. But at the time, it was a problem.
So that it was going from saying car to saying car, that it was that change, right? Yeah, so you weren't, you didn't have the rhotic Italian R at all. It was just the a slightly, you know, as you said, retroflexive R. So R, teacher.
A teacher. I'm a broadcaster. I'm a broadcaster. Mm. You know? And I can do it. It just feels fake. It feels fake to me. It's also a lot of work, you know? And I, you know, actors change their accents all the time, you know, some to, you know, greater or lesser extent of success, but they do.
Yeah.
But I think it's different if you are either on stage saying the same lines night after night, or if you are on a film where you can do it a million times, you can have different takes. You know, I do live TV news very often. You know, if there's any breaking news, forget the autocue. It's just me. And I'm often talking about things that I don't know anything about. I mean, not being funny, but when COVID broke, I didn't know the difference between a pandemic and an epidemic, you know, so you're just being unleashed on things you don't really, you know, that you're kind of briefing yourself on. And I do everything in a second language, and I do think the bilingual brain is different to the monolingual brain. To add that R, and for what? Luke, am I going to pretend to be what, from the home counties? Is anyone going to go, ooh, Babs, is she Oxford or Cambridge? I can't quite tell. I mean, you know, who am I fooling? And so when I then left British Broadcasting, because when Channel 5 also didn't work, I could have gone back to Sky as a reporter, and they, you know, they've always been great. I mean, I have to say, if there was one network that really invested in me and understood the diversity of this issue way back then, it was Sky News. I have to say that, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and then they couldn't pretend there weren't issues, and they didn't do that, but they gave me a chance. But then I decided to kind of go into international news and went to Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera English, obviously, I don't speak Arabic. And there I slowly reclaimed my R. And then I think it took me about a year and a half. And one day I just woke up, I'm like, why am I bothering? I'm on an international Arab channel. Like, no one's going to go, oh, wait. But internationally, the British accent still has an extra clout. So there were reasons.
What's interesting about, there's many things interesting about this, but one of the things that's interesting about this is the, let's say, the context in which you were trying to use English, right? What was it that, and that context defined what you were trying to do with your accent, right? So, and context is everything. So I'm just thinking of my listeners who are just sort of on a similar journey, you know, they're on a journey to improve their English as far as they can get it. And they might be facing decisions about what they should be doing about their accent, you know, and what to what extent should they be emulating a British accent? To what extent should they be trying to remove the influence of their first language on English? And what is their target accent? Now, for you, in that period, it was trying to sound British in order to be
accepted by a British audience.
Accepted by a British audience, exactly. Because, you know, as you said, it's a tribal thing. They want to hear their news being given to them in their voice. So it was that context that really made you push your English into a British direction. But then when you move into international news, that wasn't really necessary anymore. And you could, you know, speak with that retroflexive R because it's international news, and sort of global English is sort of less important. That kind of specific British accent is less important, even though, as you say, having a British accent does give you that extra bit of clout, that extra bit of status or something. But that's just interesting that context and the purpose that you're using English for is a big factor in the decision that you take about how to develop your accent, right?
Yeah. It's interesting. You used status. I think the word you used was status just now. I call it privilege. Like, to me, speaking English in whichever way is a privilege. It's about 1.5 billion people in the world that speak it. I think a billion speak it as a second, third, or whatever language. There's a reason why we all learn it, yeah? I would not have my career if I didn't speak English. Speaking English is like having the key to the, you know, interconnected global world. But then there's a hierarchy. You know, not all accents are created equal. And even to the British or American ear, you know, there's certain accents, foreign accents, I hate to say this, that are more comical than others, you know, that are often ridiculed more. And I think even in the hierarchy of native English accents, the sort of posh but not too posh Southern England accent is at the very top. The way that you speak, Luke, and I mean, I think you, it sounds strange to say, I think you have a beautiful voice, but you do. But because it's clear and because it's almost like the template, you know, that is the clear. Look at it this way. British accents are accepted in the States, in news, but actually American accents are very, very rarely accepted in news in the UK. There's something about the British accent that to me is the one that has the most authority. I'm not getting into the historical reasons or, you know, is it right? Is it wrong? You know, I could never deal with those issues. I have to be practical in my career. So to me, that context still exists. But the advice that I would give to people is, you know, all these people go, I want to sound English. I want to sound British. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but chances are you will never sound British or American or Australian or Canadian. You're going to sound like a version of what you are. And you're going to keep the accent that makes you you. And in these days of diversity, of authenticity, of be yourself, why are any of us trying to be something that we are not? Now, clarity, it's a non-negotiable. So I think it's a tricky balance between, yeah, sounding like yourself, but the bottom line is there is a correct way of pronouncing English, right? Which I suspect is why so many, you know, their listeners tune into you because they know they'll get that. So I think it's great to get the correct pronunciation and maybe try and get the flow and the expressions, but don't drive yourself nuts trying to sound like something that you will never be because it's not what you are. I could launch. You know, it's all about having an international conversation. You know, I work in news. We need a variety of voices. You know, don't talk to me about diversity if everybody sounds the same. You know, and the way that, you know, I sound the way I sound, yeah, it's mixed up, but you can tell that I started studying in English young. So what does that mean? That the literature I studied was from the Anglophone world, that the history I studied was from an Anglophone lens. You know, everything, even geography was, and it sounds crazy, but actually there's still a point of view that you can take in studying geography. History of art, history of music, everything was done from the cultural Anglophone lens. Nothing wrong with it, but there's more ways to look at the world. And so diverse voices are, I think, essential.
So accept your accent for what it is and let it tell the story of who you are. But working on clarity is a very important thing because, I mean, you know, it always comes down to intelligibility and identity, right? So these are the two factors really in pronunciation. And the identity issue is all the things you've been talking about. But then ultimately intelligibility has got to be the thing to focus on. And so that's probably got to be the measure of success in terms of accent, if you're trying to improve it. Just get to the point where people understand exactly what you're saying when you're saying it. And so, I mean, like what you did, you were able to work with someone who identified the areas where perhaps there was some lack of clarity. She called it flabby, moments where your English was being flabby, where it wasn't kind of clear. Yeah. And so identifying those things and then focusing on those things can be a very important way of improving your clarity. But it's very unrealistic to imagine you can completely eradicate any trace of your accent. It's very unlikely to happen.
Do you think that people are honest about that? Do you think that people are honest? Because I just think, I don't know, there's a lot of sort of English courses where people almost pretend. Like, I've seen a lot of ads where it's like, sound British in six weeks.
Oh, of course. Yeah, people are not honest about that. No, there's a whole level of sort of, how can I put it? without it being inappropriate, I suppose. But it's kind of like exploitative advertising and marketing, because there's a huge need, a huge demand for, you know, people learning English know that they need to improve their English. They know they need to improve their accent, their pronunciation. And so they decide, everyone's got it in their head that they have to speak like a native speaker, be it a British person or an American person. You know, they think that's the goal, but it's actually not that realistic. And yet there is a very, very strong demand for it. So naturally, people are selling to that demand. You know, that's the way that these things work, right? So people are selling this idea that, you know, speak with a British accent, blah, 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 speak with an American accent, take my course and so on. But what would be more fair would be to sell a course that promises to help people speak with more clarity.
This is why I'm going to say that I have an online course, but in fairness, I don't teach. Mine is more like the cultural. Mine is more for people that speak English really well, you know, like training journalists. But I'll tell you one thing, Luke, and with respect that maybe you and native speakers like you will never understand how embarrassing it can be, you know?
No, I know. I try and speak French.
But I don't know, but you're like forgive, but English people are always forgiven, you know, like any English person. This is it. When I am on air in Italy, because I do a lot of journalism in Italy as well.
Yeah.
When I'm on air in Italy and I make like grammatical errors or I, you know, have very anglicized pronunciations, that's almost a plus, you know, because that's almost like a seal of like, oh, she is so cosmopolitan. Look at Babs, a citizen of the world. And it is the total opposite when I make mistakes in English, right? Because English is the privileged language, right? So there is an embarrassment to making mistakes in English, which can happen to, you know, incredibly senior, accomplished, very successful people, you know, CEOs of big companies. And so there's that insecurity that people have and that frustration where you know that actually in your native language, you're amazing because, you know, you'll have accomplished whatever. And then you're totally penalizing yourself by having, you know, for example, giving an interview in English. I totally understand why so many politicians, not from the Anglophone world, refuse to give interviews in English, because it's like, you know, you're doing with your hands tied. Unless you have fantastic English. And so to me, it's the embarrassment. I mean, the one advice that I would give, I would say, first of all, that it's personal and it depends on your background. So for example, I knew, going back to the retroflexive R, that when I can make the sound that is rrr, to go from rrr to ka was just not something that was necessarily going to make my life easier. To go from rrr to car, easier. And so I made my life easier. You know, it's just easier for me to keep the R. And if people think I'm Scottish or Irish or American or Canadian, you know what? So be it. So I think for everyone, it's different. Look, anyone who can afford personalized elocution, you know, it's not cheap, but it's great. My one advice, though, go in and tell the teacher what you want, because otherwise they will do a cookie cutter version where they kind of try to make everybody sound the same. So you could just go in and say, listen to me speak. What are my weaknesses? So my weakness was the L. It was weird. It was the T, because I would say I'm getting on the tube and not I'm getting on the tube, right? Cha, ta, right? And actually English people say tube the whole time.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
fine
yeah.
for them. But with me, it impaired clarity, right? So having one-on-one, if you have the kind of job where this really matters, and if you feel that this is a stumbling block for you, then go for elocution, right? If you can afford it, look, why not? But my advice would be clear with what you want and what you don't want. My advice would be you want to be a clearer, more effective, more confident communicator. You do not necessarily want to try to pretend to be something that you're not and never will be, and quite frankly, shouldn't really try to be, you know? That would be my advice, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Okay. Now what?
I don't know. Well, we could get into the, you know, I have this newsletter, News with a Foreign Accent.
Yeah, tell us about your newsletter and your course as well.
I I'd be really interested to know what your listeners think of this, because I have this theory, or it's, I mean, a sort of like opinion I've formed, that there's no such thing as international news. People always go, oh, in the international media, there's English language news, right? I mean, around the world, it's slightly different, but certainly in the kind of like West, and I mean, outside of the UK, or even like, I don't know, the Middle East or Africa, if you have to ask, okay, international news, I think most people would think CNN. I think they'd think the BBC with the World Service. I think they'd think the New York Times, the Guardian, the Economist, the FT, right? Now, what do they all have in common? They're English language. But actually, what do they all have in common? Well, they're British and American, right? And so even a network like CNN will have CNN domestic in the US, and then it has CNN international. Now, I started as an intern at CNN international, so I know I've worked for other networks, but I mean, I have all the respect in the world for, you know, who they were, what they've become, you know, they did with the template, right? But the mothership is American. The bosses care about the American channel. Same thing with the BBC. I mean, the BBC's World Service is a powerhouse, you know? I mean, it's everywhere in the world, does a lot of good. I mean, it's financed in a slightly different way to the license fee, but the BBC has always had a massive international footprint. But ultimately, the BBC is the national broadcaster in the UK, financed by the license fee. This matters. This matters in the people that they choose, for example, to be their big presenters. Because you could have someone that presents on national BBC and then also presents on the World Service. You would not have a foreign-sounding World Service presenter as easily just jump into national news, right? Mm-hmm. And because national news is always what's important, the bosses, and again, this isn't malice, this isn't discriminating, this is just the way it is linguistically, are going to push and create stars of, you know, create the faces. Every channel needs their faces, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to pick from the pool that they can also use domestically. And it's the same everywhere. And to me, that changes the international narrative. I mean, the Anglophone footprint on it is enormous. And I know that people, you know, I worked at Al Jazeera for a long time. So believe you me, I know about, I don't want to get into that, but, you know, colonialism in news and different narratives, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of it is just simply linguistic. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. So you mean the kind of perspective of these news channels, most of them being from the UK or USA, that worldview is expresses itself through an accent or a type of language?
No, I think it's the stories. It's the slant. So,
it's the
for
stories.
Example,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and look, I think all these organizations are also trying to push diversity. But again, they look at diversity from a national point of view, right? So in the UK, we have, you know, sizable ethnic minorities, and, you know, even those words, you know, there's a lot of overlap, you know, religion can overlap with ethnicity. There's people that are first generation, others that are third generation. But, you know, in the UK, certainly a broadcaster like the BBC and all others try to reflect that. And so in turn, that would reflect their international output. But you are still reflecting something that is national. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I am Italian, yes. Am I your average Italian? No, right? And you mm-hmm. could say the same for anyone who's here, of, you know, that has more than one heritage. Ultimately, we've all been brought up, educated in, and live in the Anglophone world. It is absurd to think it hasn't affected us. And affected us even sounds, you know, I don't think that this is done on purpose. I just think in news, in journalism, you cannot negotiate or compromise on the linguistic level. You cannot hire someone who does not have perfect command of English. Because, you know, you have to use language. You know, writing a headline for the Sun newspaper is actually one of the hardest things that you can do.
Yeah.
You have to take a complex story and you have to turn it into simplistic, I don't mean it in a negative way, I mean it actually in I admire it way, simplistic language that is correct and, you know, hits home and makes people buy the paper.
And there needs to be a joke in there too, if it's the Sun.
A pun if possible, usually. Yes.
Yeah. So what's your newsletter again?
Oh, news with a foreign accent. I've kept it very much like does what it says on the tin. Mm-hmm. So it's on Substack, news with a foreign accent. And so a lot of it is linguistic, and then a lot of it is how language affects culture and the way we see things. So I do a lot of work around neo-fascism. I'm of Italian heritage, so obviously Italians have, well, you know, Mussolini sort of created the word fascism. So I look at things, and it's not that you have a different final opinion on fascism, that's not it, but just the different approaches from people's different, you know, national experiences. So that's the newsletter. And my course, though, which is very much, I mean, if you go and find me on Instagram, you'll sort of find it. But my course launches in April. I sort of open it twice a year. This is the second time I'll ever open it. It's been very interesting. It's aimed at people who speak English really well, but it's the cultural thing. And it reaffirmed how people are really embarrassed by this, because one of the things I offered in my course, one of the options, was group sessions. And so it was like individual sessions, group sessions, or just the online thing. People went for individual sessions, which obviously were more expensive, or just, yeah, no one went for the group session. Because I think people feel it's embarrassing, you know, and you feel quite exposed. So that was quite interesting.
Okay. Well, so people can find you on Instagram.
Barbara Sarah Journalist. Yeah.
Barbara Sarah Journalist on Instagram, and I'll put links in the description as well for the Substack newsletter and the course as well. But very interesting to talk to you, Barbara, and to hear about your story and all the sort of kind of interesting linguistic and cultural things that that makes us think of. So great. And you're on Sky News. What is it, every evening?
No, not at all. I'm freelance because I do a lot of other things. But Sky News is sort of my news home, right? So I tend to do the evening slot, 10 till midnight, often weekends, with the paper review. So if you tune in and you go, where does that woman come from? Then you'll know it's me.
So. Okay, fantastic. All right, lovely. Have a fantastic day in London.
It's been a real pleasure, I have to say, to sort of be able to get into these issues, which, you know, mean a lot to me and I think affected me as they do so many other people. So thank you.
So that was Barbara Sarah. Thanks again to Barbara for being involved in this episode. And what an interesting guest. What interesting things she was able to talk about relating to her experiences and her kind of status as an English speaker. Not quite a native speaker, but also not someone who speaks English as a second language. She has that sort of distinctive accent, which is certainly clear, absolutely, but it does place her in a certain sort of region outside the UK somehow. Just very interesting to hear her talking about the pragmatics of what that means in her particular industry of reading the news and what it was like for her to read the news on the UK, on UK TV, in front of a British audience and seeing their responses and stuff. Very interesting stuff. And as I said before, links are in the description for Barbara's website and her email list and so on. Thanks again to Barbara. That was really good. I really enjoyed that. And I hope you did too. You can always leave your comments in the comments section. What did it make you think of? What were some of the sort of thoughts, conclusions, realizations that you had during this episode? Where do you stand on the whole question of accent and the sort of accent that you should be trying to learn? You know, to an extent, it depends on the context in which you'll be using English. Anyway, leave your comments. I'm always interested to know what you have to say about these things. So a few other announcements. I announced the LEP meetup, which is going to happen in Da Nang in Vietnam on the on the 17th of May from 9 p.m. at Gordon's Pizza in the An Thuong area of Da Nang with Zdenek. You can just email Zdenek if you are interested in going, teachersdenek@gmail.com. I've got a couple of other little announcements to make. First of all, so my podcast host is called Acast. A podcast host is basically the sort of the service, the website that you use if you are a podcaster. So I log into Acast. I upload my episodes into Acast and add all the details, like the show notes and the title and so on. And then Acast publish my podcast on the internet, and it's captured by all these different podcatchers, you know, things like Apple Podcasts on your phone or Pocket Casts on your phone or Spotify or some other service will catch the stuff that I publish through Acast. But all my files are hosted at Acast, and they provide that publishing service for me. They're also responsible for my premium content on Acast Plus. And if you're an Acast Plus member, just sign into your account in order to manage your Acast Plus subscription and listen to my premium podcast on one of these other platforms, not Spotify, because it's not a normal podcasting app. And to do that, you just go to teacherluke.co.uk/account to sign into your Acast Plus account, where you can manage your premium subscription. So Acast is my host, and they've actually prepared a global English language survey to help inform me as a podcaster and also Acast as the sort of planning publishing entity that it is, to inform us about you, the audience. Okay, it's a very quick survey done using Typeform. It's a very quick Typeform survey. And basically, we just want to know about your listening habits, how you discovered the podcast, other bits and pieces, just generally to improve our understanding of who my audience really are. So to improve the service and just to get a better understanding of exactly who I'm talking to. The more information that we have like this, the more able I am to kind of picture who I've got in sort of listening to me out there in podcast land. A few minutes of questions. It can really help Acast. It can really help me. It's completely anonymous. No data is collected at all. You don't enter your email address. You don't even enter a name. You just answer various multiple choice questions. So it's totally anonymous and no data is collected. If you're interested in taking the survey, you'll find a link to the survey in the description of this podcast. As I said, it'll just take you a few minutes just to answer a few questions, just so that we get a better understanding of who all these ninjas are that are listening to my podcast. Completely anonymous, no data collected. Also, before the end of this episode, OPP, when I say OPP, this is a sort of code meaning other people's podcasts. So every now and then I get invited on other people's podcasts to talk about, you know, whatever it is the other podcast hosts would like to ask me about. And I've been on other people's podcasts a lot. You know, you may have heard or noticed my appearances on other people's shows. I was on All Ears English not long ago, talking about American and British English and other different podcast channels. And so fairly recently, I was interviewed by Alistair Budge on his show, which is called English Learning for Curious Minds. Actually, I think the interview wasn't published on the podcast, but it was published on his YouTube channel, where he also publishes episodes of English Learning for Curious Minds. That YouTube channel is called Leonardo English. So I was interviewed by Alistair on Leonardo English, and he asked me all about living in Paris and what it's really like to live in Paris and all of the ins and outs, all the cultural aspects of that. And the episode is called An Englishman in Paris. You'll find a link to it on the page for this episode on my website. I might as well just put a link in the description as well in the episode show notes. So Alistair Budge interviewing me about being an Englishman in Paris. You can listen to that on his show. Also, Elena Mutunono, who was a guest on this podcast a few episodes ago, talking about her work as an English teacher and then a teacher trainer and then a sort of a kind of guru for teachers who are looking to bring their work online and to create courses and attract clients and so on. So Elena Mutunono has her own podcast where she talks to English teachers about various aspects of the sort of the work and the business of being an English teacher, especially in the online arena. Her podcast is called Online Bound with Elena Mutunono. And she interviewed me for an episode of that, and she asked me lots of searching questions all about the sort of the trickier business-related aspects of running a podcast and how I come up with content and the challenges I've faced about sort of marketing the content and trying to make a living from what I do. So if you'd like to hear all of those things, you can listen to my appearance on Elena Mutunono's Online Bound podcast. Okay, links in the description. And there'll be some more coming up as well, more appearances on other people's shows. You can basically, if you want to see other appearances on other people's shows You can check a playlist on my YouTube channel. The playlist is called Luke on Other People's Shows. And also check the episode archive on my website, especially the older, previous years. Whenever I was on someone else's show, I would create a link to that in the episode archive. And the episode archive is just full of everything. It's just almost everything I've ever done, I've probably put into that archive at some point. And you can find it at teacherluke.co.uk/episodes. Okay, and that's the episode archive, and you'll find all the episodes of the podcast, but also other appearances that I've made on other people's shows over the years. For example, when I was on the Level Up English podcast with Michael, or when I was on Rock and Roll English with Martin, and lots of other things. Who else? I can't think off the top of my head right now. Aussie English, I was on that one. Plenty of others. You can just check the archive to find them. Okay. So that's the end of this episode. Thank you very much for sticking with me all the way through until this point. I hope that you found the episode to be interesting and inspiring and motivating, stimulating. You can leave your comments in the comments section. That's all for me this time. Speak to you in the next podcast. But for now, goodbye. Bye. 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 Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.